Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome everybody. Here District, I'm the captain of this vessel, Marcus Johnson, joined by my first mate, Chris Johnson. What's up, Chris?
What up, MJ?
It's all good, man. And we are still, man. Chris, as of today, we are still. I mean, can you believe it? Still the only father and son combination to win a national championship.
That's wild.
At the same school, UCLA. We still hold that record. But look, speaking of father and sons, his dad, Steve Jones Sr., was a longtime broadcast partner with Bill Walton back in the day. One of the favorites to come home and watch do NBA basketball. Steve Jones Jr., welcome to Here District once again, man. It's been about a year, man, since we had you on last, right?
It's been a minute. The team has changed a little bit, but I'm happy to be here. I'm excited.
Yeah. So listen, man, so you are the co-host and co-creator of the Dunker Spot podcast.
Correct.
And then I one of my favorites in terms of the way you break the game down on Twitter, the video clips that you pull up, the things that you look for. You were an assistant coach for the Brooklyn Nets for a year, video coordinator for the Memphis Grizzlies for a few years. And so the first thing, Steve, I want to ask you. So the last time you really worked in the NBA, it was more than 10 years ago, like 12 years ago, 2014, I believe, with the Memphis Grizzlies. How has the league changed in terms of schemes defensively, what they're doing offensively? What's been the major changes that you have witnessed firsthand?
I think the biggest thing is just teams playing faster. I think the better teams can create stronger offense. I think what you see is the teams at the bottom, they know how to play offense at a high level, right? So they can always kind of create and find their opportunities and find their shots and put you in a blender in a tough way. It's not like scouting for the Bobcats and you know, okay, if we can survive a quarter, they go struggle. It's going to be easy. We can kind of figure it out. You watch the Wizards Jazz, they can create offense. So that's been different. Less sets. You know, I think Coach Carlisle is a great example of someone who used to always call a set every time they got a rebound. And now he's someone who's going ahead and calming everything down and letting guys run. And it's just a little bit different flow-wise in that game. So defensively, it's a lot tougher. You got to guard a lot more actions. Early in the clock, teams putting more pressure on you. So you can't necessarily set your defense up in the same way. But I think the skill and the versatility that they show these days is tough to deal with.
So now, Steve, when you talk about actions, and this is where this is why we got you on the show, man. We don't need generality. What kind of specific actions are teams running more of today vis-a-vis back when you were involved actively as a coach, as a video coordinator? What's the difference in actual actions that they're running?
Now, the funny part is it's the basketball, it evolves, but always stays the same. Everybody's still running flex. Everybody's still running floppy. But I think what you're seeing is teams just kind of disguising different actions, different sets, and trying to throw defenses off that way. So they might throw, and it looks like they're running pistol to start, but it's really all that's fake, all that's fluff. They're trying to get to the second side to get to another step up. They're trying to go side to side. They're trying to trigger you in different ways. So you might think it's a wide pin down, but really it's for pick and roll. They go veer action, or they'll run stack pick and roll. So the ways the offense is getting to their sets quicker, and then they just kind of combine the actions, as opposed to back then, you knew exactly what the set was going to be. You knew how to guard the first action. If you took that away, it was really the best teams that kept you in the blender, kept you in trouble. These days, you got to keep in perpetual motion. So even a team like Golden State, they're able to just kind of read and react to what you're doing all the time and keep you in a tough spot. Like even Milwaukee, you know, they'll go ahead and looks like they're going to run a pin down for AJ Green on one side. It's really a pick and roll for Giannis with the whole right side empty. And we're just going to keep pressure on you that way.
Now, so you mentioned Golden State. And one of the things, Steve, that really impresses me about them, a couple of things, and you can relate to this because this was right in your wheelhouse. Those Spurs of about 2014, 20, you look at their pace, those old Spurs team. I'm talking about, you know, Ginobili and Kawhi Leonard and Tim and Tony Parker and Manu and that whole crew. Their pace was always toward the bottom of the league. But then when you look at speed and distance, something that a lot of the analytics guys don't like to pay attention to, they say it's a lot of noise in those particular stats on NBA.com. But I'm always fascinated with it because their offensive speed and the amount of court that they covered, they were like always number one in both those stats, like for a 4 or 5 year stretch running, which to me was like, it wasn't so much about their speed up and down the floor pace, but it's like how hard they ran their cuts. And I see that with Golden State. I mean, they keep you just on point defensively and on guard defensively because of how hard they're cutting away from the ball. And Steph is a master at that, the back cuts, all that good stuff, the splits away from Draymond, wherever he is in the post, on the right wing, wherever he is, they're always looking to do some kind of away screening split action. And they've kind of, I won't say revolutionized offense, but they've definitely put their stamp on current offensive schemes in the NBA, right?
Oh, yeah, they absolutely influenced it. And I think what you bring up with not just the pace, but the tempo, the way that they are able to move and cut and time things out to where, okay, you think if you watch Steph Curry, every time he's pointing at someone because, okay, they're denying me, I'm going to go back door. I'm going to relocate. And if they stop that, I'm going to move some more. And so the idea for teams to just keep pressure on you in different ways, I think more teams have tried to lean into that. Like even if you look at a team like the Knicks, part of their whole offensive revolution this year has just been moving, continuing to move, get to the next option, flash to the elbow. Let's get someone cutting. Let's clear a wing. Let's try and keep pressure on teams. So I think the more these days you can kind of have that feel offensively where, okay, we're moving, we're cutting, we're constantly keeping your defense rotating. You don't necessarily know what's going to happen. That's probably the best you're going to be these days.
Steve, real quick question on that. Who would you say have the top three offenses that fit that mold in which you kind of described in the NBA, like the top three of that?
I think the Knicks have been really good this year. I think what Miami has done this year has been really good as far as we're just going to try and drive the basketball as much as we can and also cut around that. I'm trying to think who else. The Thunder obviously are always going to keep you the Thunder are always going to keep pressure on you with not just having Shea, but being able to kind of have movement around him and being able to cut from the wing, be able to cut from the corner and just kind of keep pressure on you. So I think what you see is the top teams. Boston, I'd probably throw in that mix as well.
Yeah.
They are able to just kind of have this balance of, yes, we have a pressure point. Yes, we can run pick and roll. But after that first action, you still have to defend us. You have to defend us in different ways. And we're not going to necessarily stop trying to move the ball or stop trying to attack the basket.
And so now here, it leads me to my next question. And this is something, so you see, I got on my Tough Crowd t-shirt here, Brandon Jennings on the Gil's Arena show. And one thing, Gilbert Arenas, you can. You know, you could question a lot of the over top stuff that goes on that show. But when they start talking some serious basketball, they bring up some really fascinating subject matter. One of the things Gilbert spoke about recently was that he thought the rules were relaxed in terms of defense and being able to play aggressive defense because of the influx of European players and how they wanted to make it easier for the Lukas of the world and the Jokic's and people like that to score. And so, and I've noticed, Steve, you know, I'm sure we all have. I mean, the fouls out top. I mean, the inability to play a really, really aggressive defense at the point of attack has changed, right? I mean, since 10, 12 years ago, is that fed into why teams are moving more and trying to get more free-flowing offense? I mean, is there a correlation between that? Or if there's not, then maybe there isn't. But do you see a correlation?
Well, I think there's the ability to have freedom of movement has changed. So you can't really put your paws on guys like you used to be able to at the point of attack. And you're going to set a screen. Here comes an arm bar. Here comes a hand check. Yeah. I'm a ride over. There are teams and players that know how to do it. Like the Pistons, they will put their paws on you. But they also lead the league in fouls. So there's a cause and effect. I think that combined with teams just playing a lot faster, there's not a lot of catch and hold, and you have more teams switching. So, okay, how many of these defenders can keep the ball in front? The speed of the game, are they just getting beat off the drive or in rotation? But I do think the physicality has gone down a little bit. You have to be smart and time it well. Like, I think when you look at a team like the Thunder, they are a physical defense, but they know how to get away with it because they just kind of hit you four times in a row, then put their hands up. And then if you drive, they put their hands back on you again. So it's just kind of understanding how to shift. But I think offensive players also, it's a skill set to draw fouls these days as far as being able to showcase, okay, I got hit. That's a foul. And so I think it's a give and take as far as they've toned down the physicality and offensive players have gotten smarter.
Yeah, and to that point too, I mean, you know, we were playing Golden State the other night and Jimmy Butler initiated some contact that was really obvious. He just kind of threw himself into, I think, Bobby Portis or somebody else on a drive. Got to the free throw line. There's a great video going around on YouTube where this guy put together about the difference in the rules between the 80s and 90s and talking about, and it actually shows some examples of offensive fouls when Magic would go hard to the basket, or traveling violations called where, you know, based on today's game, it looked like there was none. And again, I'm not trying to, you know, prop up the old school guys, but the game seems to be a little bit more conducive to scoring now. I mean, Giannis, he's, you know, 37 points in 31 minutes, and that's not taking nothing away from him. But it's almost like, you know, you, when a guy gets a step on you, I see it often. Defenders just open up and almost give a guy a lane to the basket as opposed to the arm bar or any kind of a chuck at the point of attack because of the way the game is called. I think the, it's been almost a systematic legislation of just less contact and making it easier to score for a lot of the ball handlers. And it's, to their credit, the good players take advantage of it. They've learned how to take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. Now, it was different though, because I was brought up, you just don't call a foul, figure it out. take the bump.
Yeah. Now I'm not sure how closely you've been following these Milwaukee Bucks, man, but you know, we got to take a deep dive into them. I mean, the Bucks, what's your take on the Bucks, man? What help me make sense. You know, I'm too close to it, Steve. I'm too close to it, man. I'm right on top of it, man. Help me make sense of this. Should I be optimistic about where this team is headed, or is this pretty much, as Cameron and May say, it is what it is? What I'm seeing is kind of what it is, or is there room for some major improvement for this team to make a move and get themselves into the playoff hunt?
I think I'd deliver some optimism, because I think when you saw at the start of the season was a Bucks team that was trying to transform themselves offensively around Giannis, and they have spacing, they have more shooting, and they are a team that's looking to get the ball up quicker and get into actions quicker and stringing actions together. And the way that they use Giannis, I think, has been so important, because it's not necessarily that he's initiating all the time. It's that you don't necessarily know where he's going to be on the court. It may be a pick and roll. It may be an isolation where you have to force help. It might be an elbow catch. He might be a screener, run a dribble handoff. That kind of keeps pressure on teams that way. The tough part was when the injury started to hit. And now, yes, we have a stronger base around it, but it's a lot of threes. And so can we sustain that offensively, and then defensively, can we string together enough stops to make that offensive pace make sense? So I think one thing in today's game, if you're playing quick offensively, that's fantastic to get you the type of shot you want. Defensively, you also have to be ready to go defend. And if you start missing, if you're in transition and struggling, or you're not hitting the same rotations, it puts you in a trickier game. But I would say the fact that Giannis has played this well, Miles Turner, his ability to cut has been strong. And you've got AJ Green shooting. You got the guard play they have as far as getting downhill. In this Eastern Conference, that's very competitive. The Bucks kind of continue to work their way up. I think they can knock on some doors. Tough part is where you're at in the standings.
Yeah, I mean, the Bucks are what I think are four games out of fourth or fifth place behind Toronto. I mean, so it's not like insurmountable, but it just seems like, man, we're just consistently taking a step or two forward, two or three steps back. Just when you think this team, Steve, is about to, you know, get over the hump and string together, and they did string together, you know, five wins in seven games or whatever it was, or as Doc likes to point out. So there was some success, but that was against Charlotte and some of these other, the Bulls and some of these other teams that you would expect, you know, and I say that, you know, knowing that the Bucks have lost to the Wizards a couple of times and have struggled. Charlotte beat us down in Charlotte. But I was looking up the schedule, strength of schedule. The Bucks have the sixth toughest strength of schedule from this point out, based on opponents' one-loss percentage. I mean, so it looks like a bit of an uphill climb, a lot of road games ahead. What are you seeing defensively from this team? I mean, they don't evoke fear in the hearts of their opponents defensively. What do you see in terms of where this team can improve themselves defensively?
I think, for one, do a better job of containing the drive. I think when teams run pick and roll, they have Miles Turner who can switch or navigate, and they can work those things out. When Giannis is on the weak side, especially the backline defender, he can help rotate. When teams are able to get out and run on them, when teams are able to drive and make the Bucks help in a different way, it kind of forces some of those breakdowns where, oh, we missed a rotation, we gave up a layup, we're over helping, now it's another kick. And so I think for me, it's just sustaining and finding a way to pressure the ball, stay solid defensively, force teams to kind of get to one or two or three actions on a consistent basis. I mean, if you're up there pressuring the ball and now it's a high pick and roll, are you switching? Did you get beat on a reject? And now we're in rotation in a way that we didn't want to be. I think too often for the Bucks, they live in those scenarios where they are reacting as opposed to anticipating what team's going to do.
And does that come down to Rollins and Porter Jr. gambling a little bit or taking chances, risks, getting out of position out there? I mean, they are high level on the steel side of things, of creating havoc, you know, to being disruptive. But there's a lot of times that you see them kind of get out of position or try for plays maybe that they may not be able to make. Do you think that might contribute to some of that stuff, Steve?
Yeah, I think that plays a role in it. I think the one thing I like about both those guards is they are game. They're competitive. They're willing to guard almost someone out there on the court. The issue now is, can you kind of rein that in to where it's kind of conducive to team defense more times than not? To where, okay, I'm out here pressuring to try and get you deeper in the clock, but now if I get beat off the screen, is that doing the best for me? Are we getting the same rotations? Are we helping in the same way? So I think for them, it's just being a little bit more solid, making sure they don't get beat off the bounce, and then just playing out of it. And that way the team defense can be a little bit more solid.
Now, are you a fan of the zone defense? And I say that, you know, I know it's a broad question, but I mean, do you look at it as a way to kind of mask deficiencies or as an effective rhythm buster for good offensive teams that you're playing against? But I've been playing a lot of it.
I think it's a my thing with zone these days is, are you playing it because you want to play it, or are you playing it because you're in a spot where you kind of have to because man-to-man's not working? That's where it gets tricky sometimes. I do think it is a good rhythm buster as far as being able to take a team and slow them down and try and make them think and make them, you know, take them out of their flow and their rhythm. And to have it in your back pocket to use if we're getting dinged, I think is fantastic. The tricky part is you still have to have some of those principles and you got to stay matched up. So if the zone, if you're not matched up in that zone, the offense sees an advantage, they're going. And so is this something that is helping you slow a team down, or are you opening other things up when you go to zone? And so I always liked the idea of being able to go to a zone for a couple minutes. Let's see if we can get some stops, get out and run, get back in this game. But if you don't have the man-to-man on top of it, it doesn't have the same rhythm, doesn't have the same push and pull.
And then Miles Turner, I mean, despite you know, shooting the lowest field goal percentage of his career, like low 40s, 41, 42%. I mean, I still like Miles, what he brings to the table. Now, the last 2 weeks, he has the second best net rating on the team, almost, you know, plus 13 compared to what he was doing at the start of the season. So give us your take on Miles.
Well, I think his potential to do a lot of different things should, in theory, help the Bucks. So he's someone who can pick and pop, who can pick and roll, who can drive the basketball. I thought his cutting was really important for Milwaukee early this season, as far as being able to just randomly have some movement to kind of keep pressure on teams. And then defensively, it's just about him being a little bit more consistent with, okay, and when I switch, I keep the ball in front. When he's rotating, I think he's been tremendous as a rim protector. As sometimes a pick and roll, he can get hit a little bit, but I think it's more so the fact that he can provide a bunch of different things, and it's just about him consistently doing it. And so I think it's more so the effort and the mindset has got to be at a high enough level, but I think he's got the capability to really fill in exactly what the Bucks need.
Yeah, and then defensive rebounding, man, it's really interesting. The Bucks were kind of one of the poorest teams in the league, which has been a Milwaukee strength. For the past few years, when Brook Lopez was here and Giannis playing together under Mike Budenholzer, they were consistently top three or four defensive rebounding percentage. They've dropped off quite a bit, but they haven't been hurt, Steve, by second chance points. I mean, they're fourth in opponent second chance points. But doing a deeper dive, the one thing that was pointed out to me was that the Bucks, Steve, they give up more long rebounds off of 3-point attempts by their opponents than anybody in the league. And up to this point, the opponents have shot worse on those long rebound, second 3-point attempt shots. You know, the house money that you play with when you're trying to get your volume of threes up, and that's just kind of playing with fire. You know what I mean? It's like that shooting is going to turn around at some point. The teams are not going to continue to miss those second opportunities. And against Golden State, there was a few cases, and I mentioned it on the air with Lisa Byington, that we saw that happen, man. Now, and this leads me to this point. Steve Kerr, speaking of Golden State, he's talked about, you know, a good aggressive offensive rebounding team, which the Bucks are not. They're dead last in offensive rebounding percentage, second chance points. But a good aggressive approach to offensive rebounds can a lot of times deter transition baskets by the opposition. You know what I mean? I mean, so the coaches think, well, if I don't send everybody back, we're susceptible to transition. But it seems like a lot of teams, Steve, are turning toward going toward the basket aggressively. I mean, Houston, some other teams. I mean, Houston's kind of an anomaly. They do it at such a high rate. But this seems to be this turning of a philosophy where you're looking to go more aggressively to the offensive glass, which means that I've got to box you out. I've got to keep you away, which is going to slow me down in terms of getting into transition. And at the very least, kind of check that guy. So I don't know. What's your take on that in terms of, is that something that the Bucks you think could do? Bobby Portis and Giannis, and the Bucks' offensive rebounding with Giannis improved like 3 percentage points, like from 25 to 28 with Giannis on the floor. So do you think that's something they should look to do more of as the season progresses, or what's your take on that?
I think it's sometimes I have a struggle with this one because I understand the value of the strategy to crash the boards. And it, like you laid out, it delays transition. But I also am like, I think we should focus on trying to make the basket if we can. That's just my brain, how it works. I think that the tough part is the type of shots Milwaukee takes, such a high volume of threes. How many people are going to truly be able to crash? And especially if Miles Turner is also spaced. So if we're running an action with one guy, we take a pull-up three, you might Miles get 2 steps in, and then which of those guards is going to go? And so in my mind, it's like, okay, I mean, they're shooting, I mean, what, about 39% of their points come from behind the arc, which is fourth in the league. So how many true crashes are you going to be able to get night in, night out? That's where my brain is like, I'm not sure.
Yeah, and that's why we have you on the show, because what seemingly makes sense to me, now you point out, in terms of the Bucks and their 3-point shooting, and then especially a guy like, you know, the guys who would be the most reliable offensive rebounding candidates, Bobby Portis, you know, but he's all out along the 3-point line a lot. Miles Turner, you're all your big. So, I mean, that's a great point. Point Giannis. Are you a fan of Point Giannis? Do we put the ball in Giannis? Yeah. So Giannis, Steve, Giannis pointed out when he has 7 assists or more, the Bucks win. He said 60 to 70% of their games. We looked it up. They actually win like 69%. When he has 8 assists in a game, they win like 82, 83%. It's almost like he probably knew that, you know, before he made that statement in this post-game media conference. But are you a fan of trying to increase his usage rate? Do you think it's about where it needs to be? Do you want to see the ball in his hands even more?
I like the way that the Bucks have put the ball in Giannis's hands and the pressure that he's able to generate against defenses. And so it's not even necessarily the amount of usage, just continue to move him around the board because teams aren't necessarily going to be sure what to do with it and how to guard him because you're not sure what he's going to do. You can use him as a screener and we know the pressure he can make as a roller, but when he's bringing that ball up the court, yeah, you gotta build a wall and try and keep him in front. But if he flows into a dribble handoff, now you have to react to that. If he's able to just kind of attack and swing and get into a screen, you have to react to that. So I think the more you can kind of just move Giannis around the board with the spacing and shooting you have and kind of have a philosophy to get into things quicker. So it's not necessarily Giannis walks the ball up or we need to wait till Giannis gets in the post. No, we can get into what we want right away and then we can get it back to Giannis. I feel like that's been a difference for me watching the Bucks this year. Is Giannis has been able to put more pressure on teams because they're just more decisive overall on how they want to use him and how they want to play around him.
I mean, is it as necessary with Kevin Porter Jr., Ryan Rollins playing the way they are, being as creative off the bounce, being able to beat guys, get downhill, is it as necessary for Giannis to be point Giannis?
I think the plus of going point Giannis is the attention that defenses are going to give to Giannis. And so he's always going to generate some version of help, some version of two on the ball in a way that Rollins and KPJ may not. And so while they take advantage, they get downhill, they're aggressive, they're scoring. I've enjoyed watching them grow. You don't have to put the pressure on them to make all of the plays. So you have what Giannis does to initiate, get a team in rotation. They can play off that or they can go ahead and operate in pick and roll, but it's not like, okay, you guys have to make play X, Y, and Z for us to open things up. I think that's the beauty of the Bucks is to kind of have the best of both worlds as opposed to, okay, we need our guards to, you know, because now it becomes how many shots do they have to make before the defense reacts as opposed to Giannis is opening things up. These two are cooking. AJ Green's off screens. We have a dynamic flow as far as what we want to do offensively.
Yeah, and to that point, I mean, Giannis – his on-off stuff, I mean, the numbers, the turnover percentage for the Bucks goes down exponentially. The effective field goal percentage goes from, like, off the court 20th or so the last few weeks since he's been back, like, 8th or 9th. I mean, you can see it reflected in the numbers just in terms of the impact that he makes for his teammates. You know, Steve, I like what we have. I like the, on paper, let me put it that way. I like the depth of this team, but I don't know. What can be done to get this team to play consistent? What's the key? I mean, is it film work? Is it personnel driven? Is it trying, like Doc is doing, a lot of different combinations, guys in and out of the rotation? Cole Anthony was a featured performer off the bench now. A lot of DMPs, coaches' decision. I mean, Kyle Kuzma was a starter. Now he's coming off the bench playing well. I mean, and I'm sure if we knew the answer to this, you know, you could package it and sell it and make a lot of money. But in terms of what you're looking at with this Bucks team, man, what do you think needs to be done just to get this team operating at an optimum level from this point on, which they're going to have to do if they want to be a playoff team or be a successful playoff team? Let me put it that way. Get past a round or two. Just to get in the playoffs, first of all, let's start with that.
The defense has to be at a certain level every single night. It's one thing to maybe give up some baskets. It's one thing to kind of struggle on that end. They need to have a clear, okay, this is why our defense isn't working. It can't be the nights where we're switching and we're giving up open looks or we can't keep the ball in front. Be decisive on that end of the floor. Be consistent and solid on that end. I think offensively you feel a lot better about what you got. But if you have that consistent defense, that's going to allow you to stay in these games. That's going to allow you to hold these leads and put yourself in a position to compete at a higher level, as opposed to, okay, our defense takes a hit. It kind of bleeds into our offense. We go subs, depth, rotation, and now we're just not necessarily where we want to be. So I think it's just, to me, it's the defense. I think the offense, you've made a lot of strides. Defensively, you got to be a little bit better.
And speak to that point. And Chris, you can jump in here if you want to. So you start AJ Green and you match him up against Jimmy Butler. And AJ's had to match up against guys who are, you know, taller, stronger, more physical, and teams have kind of targeted him. Are you one to believe that his shooting and potential to kind of space the floor, score points from deep, do what he does as an offensive player, can offset any kind of challenges he may have, especially? He's not fouling. He was picking up two, three fouls early in games. That's kind of subsided. But do you think that having that lack of size at that wing spot? I mean, it used to be we want a big, strong wing defender. Now you got, and this is in defense of AJ, you got AJ at 6'4", shooting guard, having to play against some of these big, powerful wings, you know, at his position, the Jaylen Browns of the world. But do you think his shooting kind of offsets any kind of, I won't say deficiencies, but challenges he may have at the other end of the floor?
I think that's the trade-off, and that's where I think if you're more solid as a team defensively, you can help and show early help and try and say, okay, we know you want to go at him. We're gonna try and take away the driving lanes. We're gonna help, and we can play out of that. Too many times, if you show too much help or you're trying to anticipate that you're gonna have to help on a drive, now that opens something else, and now Milwaukee's in rotation. That's what you gotta avoid. But that's the trade-off. I mean, you're taking and hoping for the growth offensively. You've seen the shot making grow, and you get the benefit of that offensively. Now, if we're just more solid defensively, we can kind of take that hit a little bit more, as opposed to the feel where, okay, this is tough for us to deal with on top of what we're dealing with defensively. I think that's where it gets a little harder to swallow at times.
What about when AJ is not hitting? So since his shoulder injury, his three-point percentage has kind of tanked a little bit. Is his value the same, or would you look for something else if he's not hitting? And you still sacrificing the defensive stuff?
Well, I mean, I think you give him the room and the rope to grow. And so you never want to have the player be in that shoot or bust category to a degree where, okay, you're not making shots, come sit next to me. So you give him a little bit of room to grow, but you have Gary Trent Jr., you have other players who can get out there and kind of provide that for you depending on the night. But ultimately, you would want him to be in a scenario where we've gone through these situations and we understand even if the shots aren't making, maybe you're hitting some drives, maybe you're drawing attention, that gives us enough, and then defensively we can hold value. And you kind of want him to grow and upscale into that role. And so it's not as much as the push-pull effect that sometimes can happen when you're searching for something on both ends of the floor.
Mm-hmm. So final question, Steve, before we get into a couple of videos, then we'll let you go. But you know, and I consider myself a realist, man. And so at the start of the season, I took a lot of heat from the Bucks fandom because I didn't have Giannis at the top of my list for MVP. The way Jokic was playing, the way the Luka and Shea and all these guys, and so they were giving me a lot of heat. I'm a Bucks man. I'm a Bucks employee, so I'm supposed to promote the Bucks. That's not me. So let's look at most improved. I love Ryan Rollins. He's gone from 5 or 6 points a game to 17. He's got the you know, in terms of the leading candidates for most improved, Denny Abdia and Jalen Johnson. I mean, he's got the biggest improvement. But I just don't know, Steve, if that's going to be enough. I mean, if you had to vote right now for the most improved player, who would it be?
This is where it gets tricky, because I think there's a time where you probably have Ryan Rollins as a shoe-in. But we've kind of changed into this era where we're taking players that are already considered good and taking their leap and calling that an improvement, which I understand but have argued against, because it's like, okay, but they were already very good. They got better. I understand it. So in my mind, I'm looking at someone like Jalen Johnson might get a lot of love in this category. I'm thinking someone like Nikhil Alexander-Walker might get a lot of love because he became a 20-point scorer. Someone like Jalen Duren making a leap towards an all-star might get a lot of love from people, as opposed to like the Ryan Rollins, the Anthony Blacks of the world who have done that. Michael Porter Jr. might get consideration for this award.
Yeah.
Like, you never know which leap they're going to try and attach to people. I mean, heck, somebody might say Dylan Brooks this year. Who knows? So I think Ryan Rollins, his improvement consistently as far as being able to score the ball every night, and especially as the scouting report has changed, teams trying to pressure him more, teams trying to beat him up, and he's been able to kind of continue to produce, I think he's deserving. I don't know if we get there in 2026 with how it gets treated. I'm going to be honest.
Yeah. No. And I appreciate that, because when Giannis won the award, you know, I was with you. I thought he had made that leap the year before. And the year he won it, he went from, I don't know, he was averaging 23, 24. He was an all-star, you know, most valuable player candidate. You know, and to me, that's not, you know what I mean? They should, and that's the thing about the league that I'm not crazy about it. And it bleeds into the defensive awards too, all defensive team. It's almost like you don't want to give it to the unknown guy who's doing the grunt work, who's playing great defense, but you want to give it to one of the stars so that it becomes more of a sexy kind of an award. And I don't think that should be the criteria, just the sexiness of the awardee. It should be just kind of, you know, what a guy has done. And that's where, I don't know, and I hearken back to the olden days when the players were voting, and not to say we were perfect with the way we voted, but it wasn't a lot of these other factors that you looked at a guy who locked me up. E.C. Coleman played with Golden State back in 1979. Nobody ever heard of him. But he made second team all defense because we all knew at 6'8", 225, he was going to lock you down. You know, that's what's up. You knew. You know, if you look at the all defensive team, you see his name on there. And then all of a sudden it kind of morphed into Larry Bird started taking his place as a second team all. And we would look at that and be like, Larry Bird over E.C. Coleman, are you out of your mind? But I don't know.
The truth comes out.
Huh? Well, no. I'm just saying that as a ball player, you know who gives you a hard time and who doesn't. You just know that.
Facts.
And so,
facts.
I don't know, Steve. I mean, you could comment on it or whatever. But just to your point about Ryan Rollins, in other years, another time when it was just complete, you know, objectivity and not all this room for interpretation and sexiness and all that, I think he'd be a shoo-in. But in today's climate, I just think it's going to be difficult, despite how well he has played and improved his numbers.
Yeah, I'm with you. But man, when the players voted, who used to get mad the most?
I don't remember. You know, I mean, like the year I made first team all pro in 79, it was me and Moses and Gervin and Elvin. Hey, I mean, you know, it was a pretty, I don't think it was, you know, any argument. Then the next year they took the voting from the players and gave it to the media. And that's when Larry Bird, as a rookie, made the first team all pro team. And Larry Bird even said that year at the All-Star break that, you know, he didn't think he deserved to be an All-Star because there were so many forwards, Adrian Dantley, Mike Mitchell, so many guys they thought were better than him at that time. So I don't know. You know, that's up for debate. And again, the players weren't perfect, but I think the media can get into kind of a popularity contest or, you know, and here's the other point. And I mentioned this on the air the other day. Rookie of the year, when the media was voting, Stevie Francis and Elton Brand were neck and neck. And I think one guy may have led the other by 2 votes. I got a call from the NBA office asking would I change my vote from Elton Brand to Stevie Francis just so they could give them co-players of the year. So that's the kind of things that were happening behind the scenes to make it a better story. You know, that's a better story. Now we got these co-players of the year And I said, yeah, fine, do what you want to do. But I look back.
Oh,
on
so
it
you're
now,
the reason. You're the reason.
Well, that one of them didn't win the award outright. You know what I mean? But you know, it wasn't a big deal to me. But again, it's a different time, man. But listen, man. All right, Steve Jones. I mean, you do this as well as anybody. The video breakdowns, man. If you haven't seen Steve Jones's work on Twitter, make sure you check him out. But right now, about that action, this is our segment where we look at some videos of the Bucks defensively and Golden State game, the perfect example. Now, here's a couple of good defensive plays against Steph Curry. Let's roll it, Steve, and you can talk about kind of what you're seeing out there.
Good ball pressure, but I think if you go back, it's the effort to kind of just figure out how to navigate. Not a perfect world on this pin down, but hey, Giannis is aware. We're fighting back to get back in. We're going to contest. Everyone's trying to get back in on the glass. And so that's kind of consistent effort they got to try and find.
100%. That's the thing I noticed on it, Steve. It's like everybody on that side playing in that action is aware of Steph. They're cognizant. They're ready to switch if they have to. Like you mentioned, Giannis, and that level of focus by possession is how you get better, in my opinion, on defense. If they can sustain those type of efforts on the matchups that matter, that's when you see the jump. And we've seen a jump in their defensive rating over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, we have. And one thing right there, the ball pressure, Steve, you mentioned it. That was part of the game plan. Miles Turner, Draymond picks it up. You're all over him. Back up off him when he's got the live dribble. As soon as he picks that thing up, ready to pass, you know, get your hands active, make it difficult for him. And then Ryan Rollins, I didn't realize Steph had played him so aggressively. That little pushdown right there to get free of his former teammate with Golden State. But to Ryan's credit, he got right back up and got in great position to contest that shot. So that's a testament to him kind of staying with it and making that second effort. Okay, let's look at the second play. The second good defensive possession by the Bucks. Here comes Steph. Little high ball screen, little get action from Draymond. And yeah. Go ahead.
Now, the thing I like here is Rollins is pressuring the ball. Kevin Porter Jr. does his job, stays at home. And Miles Turner is up. And so hey, I'm here to take away and navigate that drive. You might not come to me, but Ryan Rollins being able to kind of get slim, not get screened, fight over, get in a position to contest quickly. Those are the kind of little things that you need if you're Milwaukee. And so just collective team effort. Like KPJ doesn't even think about jumping out and switching. So it's on Ryan Rollins. Miles Turner's up, and we're just going to try and do the best we can against the type of player that Stephen Curry is.
And look how physical Kevin Porter Jr. is with Jimmy Butler on the screen. He's in his back. He's giving him a bit of a push. Watch this right there. You know, just kind of pushes him up a little bit, makes it just a little easier for Ryan Rollins to kind of navigate getting around that screen. And I mean, those, as you talk about little things, those are the kind of little things that you've got to continue to have.
And then I was just going to add too, if you look on the weak side, AJ Green, to his credit, he's ready to be in because Jimmy's rolling, KBJ's holding. And those are the kind of solid things that Milwaukee has to do consistently if they want to build that defense back up.
Five guys with a string. All right. So those are two good defensive plays. Now let's take a look at the not so good. All right. Let's roll this third play. All right. Golden State in transition. Podziemski. And that tap out off the missed three. Again, that offensive rebound off that missed 3-point shot. And right to Steph Curry. Anything that jumps out at you guys on this, Chris, Steve?
Well, I was just going to say transition defense, you all got to have the mentality not just to get back, but get ready. And so you have four back. You got to get that ball. And so you got to be able to box out as a team. You got to get that ball and you've got to be able to find a way to kind of match up. Like you're running to Steph Curry because you have to, but look to find a body, turn to get the ball. Those are the kind of possessions you can't afford when the defense isn't performing at the highest level, especially when you're on the road. Those are the little ones that add up night in, night out.
And Chris, look at Ryan Rollins. Does it bother you after the initial contest, kind of his mindset going toward the baseline? Chris, take a look at this. Tell me what you see.
Yeah, he like runs by and there's no sense of urgency watching that, like the walk back. I guess, you know, it's just having a sense of urgency to finish the possession.
Yeah. But anyway, little things count. And right there, I mean, just out of the play right here, just a count or two. And sometimes that's all it takes. Give Podziemski a lot of credit for recognizing that Steph was open on that tap out. All right, next play.
So this is what you had. Two things you can't do. Stephen Curry sees that much space, you know he's going to let it fly. So we have the physicality here, but Bobby Portis is deep. It's already gone. Got to get that rebound, especially against that team in that building.
There's Bobby Portis on Al Horford here. Bobby Portis steps up to help. I mean, God, that long, see those long threes, lead the long rebounds, goes right over Bobby's head. Not to say that he's at fault or should have sought out the body of Al Horford and boxed him out aggressively, but there's got to be a little bit more awareness of where those long rebounds. You got to have a guy right around that free throw line. You know what I'm saying? There's got to be a rebounder cognizant that there's a Gary Harris. Somebody's got to be around that free throw line just in case.
Here's my question. Should Gary Harris have sold out a little more on that play? Did you see it? Got close. He stunted. Yeah, Harris stunts on the pass from Pods. Watch here. I mean, I guess he couldn't have got there, but it seems like if he wanted to, with a sense of urgency, he could have, you know, ran some interference, put a hand up, and he wouldn't have been out of position because Pods is way out here. But anyway.
I think I didn't mean to cut you off, but it's another possession where everyone kind of drifts as soon as Steph Curry puts it up. So you can see KPJ on the trail. He just pulls to the other elbow. But go ahead.
No, you're right. Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. Watch it again. Everybody's drifted.
The drift. Everybody's kind of the drifting.
I mean, not in a rebounding mindset. You know, it's not like, okay, I'm watching. Everybody just kind of looking and
let
watching.
Let me find somebody.
Yeah. But then surprise when it's a long rebound. And now you're in a scramble situation, and Steph thrives in those kinds of situations. So that's a great point. You got to cut out the drifting on the shot attempt because long threes lead the long rebounds. We know that. You know, it's as obvious as a nose on your face, so don't be surprised. The only guy boxing out aggressively is who? Gary Trent Jr. Watch Gary Trent and Santos right side of your screen. Look at it. You know, he's the only guy that is at least making an effort to get a body on somebody. Everybody else is just kind of turning and watching, and you see the result of it, man. So these things have got to improve. All right, let's go, Dylan. Last one.
Now these are the plays where if Milwaukee can be cleaner on the back line, they'll feel better about where they're at. Bobby Portis does his job. We're up. Giannis is there, but we gamble to the corner, which opens up another pass. We're playing 2-on-1, and now we're in rotation because Giannis holds here. Ryan Rollins overplays, and now we end up leaving Steph Curry wide open. And so if we can just be contained a little bit more, trust Giannis to make that play. Trust you can get out on the actual pass. And then kind of be more solid defensively. You put yourself in a strong position, but you put two on the ball and Steph Curry ends up being wide open. It's hard to afford that.
So now when you say cleaner on the back line, what are you saying? See, with Ryan Rollins should not have stunted toward D'Anthony Melton, or what are you saying?
So Giannis is right there on the Horford catch, and Ryan Rollins did the right thing at first as far as trying to split between Santos and D'Anthony Melton. The issue is he overplayed that corner pass, and there's no one to help him. And so at that point, you might have a corner pass, but trust that you can get there once it's thrown.
Yeah.
You got to split to be able to play that next pass to give Gary Trent a chance to come back, to give Bobby Portis a chance to come back into the action.
Yeah, and that's my point. Sorry to cut you off, Steve, but to my point is Ryan overplays to such a level where Gary Trent feels like he's got to close out on Santos instead of going straight to Steph. So, it's like I guess Rollins got out of his vision because he went so far. Because why is he going to Santos? You know what I'm saying? Why wouldn't he just go straight to Steph?
Yeah, no, Ryan definitely. I mean, Ryan could have split the two, and as Steve pointed out, not overcommitted toward the baseline. Man, look, D'Anthony Melton, 22% from the 3-point line coming into this game, but he did have like 4 or 5 threes on the night. Balling. So he was a hot shooter. Yeah, he was a hot shooter. Not to excuse Rollins for overcommitting, but you've just got to play that a little smarter. And yeah, two to the ball. You prevent the two to the ball at all costs, and especially when the two to the ball, when that ball is not Steph and you're leaving Steph wide open. Two to the ball here, Steph is wide open. You know, you're asking for trouble, man. Yeah, and you found it last night. You found it, especially down the stretch in that game. So, but listen, Steve Jones, man, the dunker spot. We thank you so much for joining us. We got to bring you back before this season's out and just have another great in-depth basketball conversation. Always a pleasure, man. Keep up the good work that you're doing. And we thank you so much, man, for joining here this afternoon.
Thank you all for having me. Appreciate it.
Appreciate you.